Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program. We do come your way on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. and Monday mornings at 1 a.m. And at that time, we stream live the broadcast. And we podcast. Well, that's what they call them now. And we do it on the radio show's page of richarddugan.com as well as SoundCloud and iTunes formats. And so we encourage you to check out the interview, this one, and of course, many, many others, hundreds, literally hundreds of others. And we also link to our guest's website. We'll be giving you that website address in just a few moments. And I think that you're going to enjoy today's program. I know that I am, because in spite of the fact that, as I've mentioned many, many times, my metaphysical primer was Autobiography of a Yogi. And my guest has read the book as well, probably numerous times. And he is going to share with us today his insights through a work that he has written, and it is called The Life of Yogananda. My guest is the author of this book, having to do with Paramahansa Yogananda, for those of you who are not familiar with the name. And we encourage you to investigate the story of this very interesting man. And my guest is Phil Goldberg, Philip Goldberg, and he is on the line via Skype, and we're talking about the story of the yogi who became the first modern guru, might even say superstar. Philip, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
My pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
This conversation is going to be very interesting because I enjoy speaking about this man. I suppose if he were alive today, I doubt that I would be following him per se, as many people would. I've never been a follower of individuals, but I have always been intrigued at the age of 17 by the works, and I know that you've read it as well, Autobiography of a Yogi. My first question to you in the regards to the life of Yogananda, the work that you have put out, why did you feel it was necessary to expand upon what was already, I guess, available to the masses?
Well, when I was working on my previous book, American Veda, that book covered the whole history of all the spiritual teachings that came here from India and the impact it's had on American culture. In that context, Yogananda was a towering figure, a highly influential teacher, perhaps the most important teacher, certainly up until the 1960s. And I also became aware of how truly interesting his life was as a narrative of an exceptional human being's life. And I thought, that story should be told in all of its fullness. If you read Autobiography of a Yogi, you become aware of how much is left out. A lot of the book is about other people, not just himself. So the autobiography part is only part of that book. And he leaves out big chunks of his life. I did a page count, and less than 10% of Autobiography of a Yogi takes place after Yogananda comes to America. And that's where he spent 32 of his 59 years, and where he did his major work, where he established a global reputation and his headquarters of his organization. A lot was left out. There are periods of 4 to 5 years in his life where he just sums it up in a sentence or two. And so I realized a lot was left out. There are other books, as you said, that are mostly tribute books written by direct disciples, people who knew him. They're not really biographies. They're sort of the Yogananda I remember. And so I thought there was a need and an opportunity for a full-scale, objective biography that covered his whole life.
What was it, or is it, about Paramahansa Yogananda that intrigued you so much, not only in terms of why you would then write this particular work, which you've explained rather eloquently, but was there a particular incident in your life, in your past, that drew you to either Paramahansa, then autobiography, or vice versa, the book, and then the guru, in terms of leading you down this particular path, and obviously with all of the other writings that you've done as well?
Well, I first read Autobiography of a Yogi in 1970. I was already deeply immersed in a spiritual path that centered on the Vedic or yogic teachings of India. I was, excuse me, I was about to become trained as a meditation teacher in a different lineage, but I was reading all kinds of works, and the Autobiography of a Yogi was one that was extremely popular in my circles at that time, and it was influential in my life. It was very extremely informative. He talked about things I hadn't come across before. And it was a wonderful portrait of genuine Indian holy men and women who he knew, and a portrait of a developing yogi who became Yogananda. So I was intrigued by it, and it was one of many books that informed and inspired me. Later, Yogananda became one of those teachers who was influential, but I never became a student of his or a disciple. I had my own path, but he was just one of the teachers I respected a great deal and whom I learned from. And then when I was writing American Veda, I came to appreciate his importance in the history of modern spirituality more than I had previously. And as I said, I just got really intrigued by his personal story. So he appealed to me both as a spiritual seeker and practitioner and as a writer and storyteller. Does that make sense?
It makes absolute sense, yes. And now we acknowledge, I'm sure both of us do, that Paramahansa Yogananda, he was just a man, just like you and me. And yet he chose this particular path. One of the things that I find interesting, and I didn't even think about this even as I've read it countless times, that he was not only, and I'm just kind of paraphrasing from what I have read from the website, he was not only a rule keeper, but he was also sort of a rebel. And, you know, there's that dichotomy. As a matter of fact, what came to mind when I read those words was the story of him heading off to the Himalayas as a young boy against older brother's admonition. And yet, even in the telling of the story, when he referred to addressing his brother in a certain way, well, this is the customary way that you address your older brother because he's the one who's calling the shot, so to speak. And yet, is running off against his brother's wishes off to the Himalayas.
Well, and his father, who
and
he
his
adored.
Father.
And who he, you know, revered to the utmost. His father was trying to steer him in the direction of a more conventional life of an Indian in that early part of the 20th century. But it was not to be done. Life is very paradoxical in most cases, and his life is no exception. So you're absolutely right. He was a very interesting blend of an independent spirit who was not about to, even as a child, was not about to do what he was told without some challenge, and who was unconventional in many ways. And not amenable to acquiescence to authority. At the same time, he was very traditional in many ways and valued the traditions that he came from and valued his parents and went to see every guru and swami he could, who passed anywhere near where he was. He was a great seeker, but and the imprint of somebody who was destined to be not only a seeker of self-realization in the Hindu context, but a spiritual leader was very clear right from the earliest parts of his life. And yet that always, that dichotomy of being independent and rebellious and at the same time highly respectful of authorities, elders, tradition, was part of his life throughout. One of the things I always admired about Yogananda, the grown-up teacher in America, was that he was extremely creative and innovative about adapting traditions of traditional teachings that he brought from India to the Western way of life at that time in history. And at the same time he was being innovative, he was he adhered to tradition and adhered to the way those teachings should be presented and transmitted. So you have this balance throughout his life, visible even as a boy. And that's one of the things I found fascinating about him.
And indeed, he is a fascinating individual. And I'm curious as to your impression of how you think he would be received today. Here we are in the second decade of the 21st century.
Yeah, well, it's hard to imagine because, of course, you know, he would carry himself differently. He would speak differently, you know, because times have changed. It's been almost a century since mm-hmm. he first arrived in America. He came here in 1920. He died in 1952. The world is very different. And as I said, he was fairly adaptable. So, you know, he would have adapted to the time. Now, how would he have been received? I think we have a clue in the sense that he is still remarkably popular. Autobiography of a Yogi is still read by thousands of new people every year, all these decades after it was first published. The teaching institutions that represent his legacy are very active, very visible. And so it's easy to imagine that he would be popular now as he was then. In the 20s and 30s, there weren't a whole lot of Indian swamis teaching in America. And now, of course, there's gurus. It's not big news when a guru comes to town. And thousands of Westerners have been trained by the gurus over the last 40, 50 years to represent these teaching lineages, the yogic teachings of all kinds. And so he wouldn't be the novelty that he was back then, and he would have plenty of seekers would have plenty of other alternatives, alternative teachers, teachings, lineages, and so forth. And at the same time, he would not be facing the same degree of prejudice, racism, religious bigotry that he had to deal with back in the 20s and 30s.
I have to wonder, though, he may not face the same, but it seems to me he'd be facing some, because with what we are dealing around the world, especially when we start talking about the issue of immigration, is really an unfortunate thing. And I'm wondering too about the aspect of people's curiosity. You know, you talked about how there are these other, schools lineages of sorts. I mean, here in Santa Barbara, for example, or in Montecito, we have a monastery or a hermitage, if you will, run by a gentleman by the name of Swami Vidyadishananda with the self-inquiry life fellowship. And of course, Paramahansa founded the self-realization fellowship.
Yeah. And you also have the Vedanta Society right down the road.
Right. And then of course you have another gentleman we've had on the program who has of course since passed, Swami Kriyananda, Sri Kriyananda. Mm-hmm. And his recollections of Paramahansa. And I'm curious as to, first of all, and I'm not trying to make a comparison between these two characters, but when you read the New Testament Gospels, there's a lot missing from that man's story.
That's for sure.
Okay. There's a lot missing there. And there's nobody we can go to now to try to fill in those gaps. If we find ancient writings in a clay pot somewhere buried in a cave, well, then there may be, if you're willing to accept the validity of those, then maybe there's an explanation of, oh, this was written between his 20s and 30s or 30s and 40s or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, who did you go to? Where did you go to gather this additional information to help people to better understand who and what Paramahansa Yogananda was in your book, The Life of Yogananda?
Well, for one thing, biography of a yogi or the equivalent, it was close enough in time. It was far away enough in time so that there were not many people alive who knew him. And I only got to talk to two. So that's one thing. But people who did know him, particularly disciples of his, wrote a lot, or I should say a number of them wrote, usually small books, with anecdotes and stories and their recollections. I had access to those. The Self-Realization Fellowship's archives are quite extensive, and they shared with me to the extent they were willing. Other people had become informal students of Yogananda's life, usually devotees who were fascinated by his life and looked into, did whatever work they could to gather information that was not previously published. People had constructed timelines. I had access to that. There were government documents. He was involved in a couple of lawsuits, major lawsuits in the 20s and 30s. So there are court documents. Who had letters, exchanges of letters between Yogananda and others, like relatives of theirs. And so between what was published and what was unpublished, between the people who in some cases became quite obsessed with gathering information about Yogananda, I was lucky in that all these people were kind enough to share information. You go to the newspapers, you realize where he was at a certain times. You go to the newspapers and see what they wrote about him. There's a lot of things people can do. There are government documents because he went through the immigration process. He was, all but a few years, he could not be a citizen of America. At that time. And it was, so there are all kinds of documents that I was able to come across. I'm sure there's still plenty out there that I didn't come across. Somebody else will.
I'm sure they will. And again, who knows, maybe somebody also maybe have used a 2,000-year-old method and put those writings into a clay pot and buried it in a cave somewhere.
Yep, you never know. That's the equivalent in our age might be, an online file somewhere.
Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing. And of course, then you have to find what they call the Easter egg on the website in order to access it.
Yeah,
It's just
things happen. Yeah. So, more information will be coming out about an important life like his over the course of time.
I'm curious as to your perspective on some of the spiritual and or supernatural occurrences, especially spoken of in autobiography. I'm thinking specifically of one, and that was after seeing a particular cinescope, as they referred to it, he too was taken outside and was given a thump on the chest and suddenly was able to see and hear. It was like an awareness, an omnipresent awareness, which I can't even imagine. I've been to Disneyland and I've been in their 360-degree screen, but I don't think that's anything compared to that experience. Did you find any other experiences that people talked about as far as his Paramahansa's life is concerned?
Well, there are people who claim to have had certain miraculous experiences, like him appearing to them and all that, but I don't know what to make of that. The amount of so-called miracles and wonders that he wrote about in his autobiography was pretty remarkable. I've found over the years there's two kinds of people who love that book. People who love it because of all the miracles and wonders and far-out stories, and people who love it despite that, because they don't believe any of it, but they like everything else about the book.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you believe the stories he tells of the miraculous things that these yogis have done, or he says they have done, and the evidence he offers for, or in explanations he offers for the powers of mind and the ability of a highly evolved consciousness to have influence over matter and other phenomena, whether you believe all those stories are true, or you believe he was himself duped by mm-hmm. people who were tricksters, or he was just too credulous, or if you even think he was making stuff up and saying they were true just to get your attention as a teaching instrument. Whatever you think, there's reason, you can marshal evidence and you can marshal a good argument to support it. Personally, I can't vouch for every story he tells, and obviously who could? But I think there's very convincing evidence from Yogananda and many, many other teachers and the traditional texts in the yoga tradition, there's reasonable explanations for the ability of highly developed yogis to do what we would consider super normal feats.
Yeah.
Now, that having been said, there's also a tradition in India that of tricksters, of people who claim to be great yogis who essentially are doing the kind of magic tricks you can find in Las Vegas to dupe tourists and dupe people into becoming followers or giving them money or whatever. So we have both sides of that picture, and people should come to their own conclusions.
And when I read the miracles of Jesus in the Gospels in particular, the thing that has always intrigued me was not the specific miracles, quote-unquote miracles, that he performed, but that when pressed by his followers, the apostles, hey, that's pretty neat stuff. Can we do that too? And he says, yeah, you guys can do this, but you guys are going to do greater things.
That's right. Even greater things than I.
Yeah.
And that's
go ahead.
A big part of the teaching that people don't remember.
Exactly. And of course, then you start to speculate. Well, what would that be? What could that possibly be? And then I begin to start to connect both Paramahansa with Jesus and others. And I think also of Sri Yukteswar's book, Holy Science, that sort of tries to bring the two together, if you will, and say that, hey, all religions basically are going in the same general direction and so on and so forth. I'm curious as to your perspective, your observation, your thought as to what is the one key message that Paramahansa was trying to elicit or to disseminate, if you will, not just to the West, but to the whole world.
Well, if you boil it down to its essence, his message was perfectly consistent and not different from that of every guru, spiritual master, swami, holy person who ever came from the East. And those messages are perfectly consistent with the great sacred texts of India, like the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads, and that it's a message of oneness. It's a message of the essential unity of all things, grounded in a essential essence. I said essential essence. Grounded in an essence that goes by many names that some call God, that in India is called Brahman. The Buddha is called Buddha nature, this essential unity that underlies and permeates all things, also underlies and permeates who we are. And tapping into that, discovering that, realizing what we really are, is the goal and essential definition of yoga. And so that unity of the individual consciousness with the infinite, eternal consciousness of the universe, the self of all selves.
Yeah.
That's the message, and the sub message is when you do that, you are laying a foundation for a fulfilled life, for a self-realized life, and for a happy and healthy life in the short term. Mm. And so that's the essential message. That's always the essential message that came from the teachings that originated in India. And then as branches of that core teaching, you have hundreds and hundreds of different lineages and sects and so forth that have their own ways of applying those principles and making them realizable in our lives. His Kriya Yoga was one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can't say that I have practiced that or even learned it, but I am familiar with it, and obviously the Kundalini energy and so forth. And the other thing, too, that I find interesting, and we're getting these conversations in other programs as well, that I don't even want to use the word religion. I want to more focus on spirituality, if you will, or maybe philosophy. And science are actually becoming one in the sense that our physicists, for example, are telling us through their research and findings that everything is energy, you know, and it's all made of the same stuff, you know.
Yep.
And that's what the ancient wisdom teachings, as I like to call them, are telling us, too, that we're all made from the same stuff. We all come from the same source. I get this question quite often, though, especially, you know, in terms of talking about, you know, this aspect of existence. You know, we're trying to figure out, the theory is that, of course, everything was created from the Big Bang. Well, okay, but what came before it? What was in existence? Because you can't make nothing, you can't make something out of nothing, or can you?
Or maybe you can.
I'm thinking, okay, maybe you can. It's one of those questions I used to say to people. In talking about my life and so forth, I would say, well, as far as I know, I didn't create myself. But then again, I don't know. And how would you? How would you actually be able to answer that question with any level of certainty? Because we've got so many other distractions going on that sort of get in our way of the ability to focus on those kinds of things. I want to continue our conversation. Philip Goldberg is my guest here on Tell Me Your Story. We are talking about, of course, his latest work, and that is Yogananda. It is the life of Yogananda. It is the story of the yogi who became the first modern guru. And we encourage you to stay with us here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World.
Stories, I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for staying with us, and the same to you, Philip. I really appreciate the fact that you're taking this time out of, I'm sure, can be a very busy schedule to share with us your insights, not only about Paramahansa, but also about your life and your spiritual walk as well. I think that one of the things that, I don't know about you, but one of the things that I find so fascinating is as I talk with so many different people and find out about their spiritual upbringing, if you will, how even though the names are different, it's like they all seem to converge and go all in the same direction. And again, just as Paramahansa's teachings talked about and all of the ancient wisdom teachings around the globe have talked about, share with us a little bit about your upbringing and your philosophical roots.
I was raised in Brooklyn, New York, before it was fashionable, by working class parents who had no use for religion whatsoever. I wouldn't even say they were non-religious. I would say they were anti-religious. They were in the old Marxist religion is the opium of the people sort of mode. They thought it was foolish. And so I had no religious upbringing. When I was in a college in the 60s, I was a radical political activist and trying to change the world and end the war in Vietnam and all that stuff. But I was desperately seeking truth, trying to find answers to the big questions of life. Who am I? What am I doing here? How do you live a happy life? What's it all about? And desperately trying to come to terms with my own future. And in that context, back in the days when hippies were first coming into being, the books about the East, about Eastern philosophy, and the traditional texts of those traditions, mostly what we call Hinduism and Buddhism, were finding their way into the hands of questioning, inquisitive young people, and I was one of them. And that's, as we said before, when I read Autobiography of a Yogi. Well, that came a little later. But something about the teachings of the East really resonated with me. I had not given any thought to religion. I just thought, like all the other institutions in our lives at that time, I didn't find real truth there, and I didn't find the real keys to how to live a life. But when the teachings of the East came my way, it was some form of recognition that was kind of mysterious, but I couldn't get enough of it. I wanted to find out more and more because it appealed to different parts of my personality. For one thing, the teachings did not ask you to believe stuff that's hard to believe. It was not based on belief or faith. And no one said you must convert and you must, you know, believe in this or you'll go to hell or any of that stuff. You can just yourself. Try them out. We know they work. They have effects on our lives. They can transform for the better. You don't have to believe what we say. Try the methods and then see if it makes sense to you. See if it works. See if it appeals. And I liked that freedom of inquiry, and I liked the rationale of it, and I liked the empirical nature. That appealed to me, and that's how I moved from the direction of being, you know, an outspoken atheist and materialist into becoming a spiritual seeker and later a spiritual teacher. It was a turnaround for me. In some very eventful years of my life. Thanks for asking.
Well, and I think that people are interested in knowing where someone comes from philosophically more. And of course, I approach it more because I'm curious, not because, okay, let's see if he says something I can pass judgment on and I can send him to hell kind of thing. It's extremely important for us, I think, to get a perspective on where we come from. Because, again, as we have literally reiterated numerous times already, we all come from the same place, and we're all going to the same place. But for whatever reason, we've chosen this earth, this reality, you know, as referred to, this is all Maya. It's all an illusion, granted. But we've chosen this illusion to, I don't know, somehow, I suppose, cement in ourselves somewhere along the way that, oh yeah, I forgot that we were all one. but sometimes it might take more than one lifetime if you choose to believe in that particular philosophy of reincarnation.
Well, if you do believe, it already has taken more than one lifetime if you have that perspective. And yeah, and complete realization maybe. I'm absolutely convinced that, you know, the higher states of human development, as they've been described in the ancient texts, are achievable in anyone's lifetime. But that doesn't mean they will be.
Right, right.
And depends on, a whole boatload of factors about how you live and what your priorities are and what your karma is and what the influence of your past experiences are and all the rest of it. But that's, you know, one thing, this, you know, possibility of ultimate liberation and inner freedom that the yogic texts point to. The other is, along the way, it's not as if everything is stagnant. Practicing these methods, whether it's the ones Yogananda taught or the ones any of the other gurus and swamis and Buddhist masters have brought to us, they have a transformative value, and it's going to improve your life in the short run, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, holding out the promise of long-term exalted states of being.
You and I both know that we've known people that we've come across who have a reverence for certain individuals. They seem to, again, for reasons only they know, following this person, whether they be of a particular faith or philosophy, teaching, what have you, they, you know, this person can do no wrong, or, you know, this kind of thing, and they're really serving me and helping me and so forth. And then there are others like myself who love to hear about, read about, and have experiences in relation to that individual and what they have brought, say Paramahansa or Jesus or Buddha or Muhammad or Zoroaster or whoever else you want to list, Wayne Dyer, Greg Braden, Philip Goldberg, and...
No thanks.
Okay, and I'm just curious as to I'm curious about the processes and trying to raise my awareness and my consciousness above the melees and the minutia, so that I can live a more peaceful life in that regard, and then assist others, which is what I feel that Paramahansa and people like him are trying to do. What is your perspective or perception or level of reverence, I'll say on a scale of 1 to 10, of say Paramahansa, and or is there one or are there several individuals down through history up to the present day that you lean towards more than others, or are you devoid of the messenger and you are focused on the message?
We all need guides. We all need teachers, especially in the early stages of our quest. And so I had mine as well. I like to say I learned from everybody and all the gurus, but obviously some more than others. Back in the late 60s, I learned transcendental meditation not long after the Beatles did. Made it a household word, and I found it so effective. I went and spent time with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and became a teacher of that method. And I served in that capacity for several years in the 70s. And then I felt the need to be more independent and to draw from many other teachers, including Yogananda. People have been drawn to different teachers at different times in their lives. And to be honest, some of those teachers turned out to, be riddled by scandal and other revelations. But their devotees, nevertheless, had their lives transformed for the better. So there is some danger in being in putting gurus on a pedestal and finding out that they're human and not gods. But at the same time, we don't want to be cynical and close ourselves to the possibility of learning from any teacher who has something to offer and who knows something we don't. But if we go too far and become overly reverential and surrender our will, that can be dangerous. So everybody has to find their own teachers and their own, carve out their own best way of relating to those teachers. But the ones I favor tend to, come from a lineage that has a track record of success and reliability. At the same time, there are plenty of, gurus who just are self-made in the sense that they did not come from lineages, and achieve a certain degree of revelation, realization, and a certain degree of have a certain degree of charisma and the ability to teach, and they attract a following and create new lineages. So there's very few rules in that regard, but I just would urge anybody who's on a spiritual path turning to teachers who are elevated in the eyes of their followers to be discerning and ask tough questions and put them to the test.
You know, about 25, 30 years ago, I acquired the first audio recordings, and then weren't referred to as audible books back then. They were just recordings of the Bible, both Old and New Testament. I think Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. had recorded a set, and that's going back a few years, no question. And now I have on my phone, in addition to Autobiography, I have several others. I have the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, and I'm sitting here and I've seen copies of...
Even the Mahabharata fits on the phone?
It does. Yes, it does.
Wow.
Which is amazing. Well, I bought like 120 gigabyte storage device, so I've got lots of room. And what is so amazing to me, I've seen the print versions of some of these books. They're huge. And I'm thinking, yeah. Oh, my Lord, this person sat there for hours and hours reading this. And I often wonder if any of this had any impact on them. I would love to talk with them and say, you spent 97 hours reading this book. Just, it's a number.
Yeah, it'd be a good question to ask Ben Kingsley, who narrated the Autobiography of a Yogi.
My first rendition, of course, was through Recordings for the Blind out of New York, and it was read by a gentleman who I've been trying to find the original recordings. Now, I managed to make some cassette copies that I transferred and digitized, and I have on my phone, along with Ben Kingsley. And of course, it's just familiar. I just like the way this guy speaks, and he's so fluent with the Indian words and so forth, and the Sanskrit. And so, you know, every time I listen to it, it's like, oh, it's like going back to when I was 16 or 17 years old and when I was first listening. But I'm curious, do you have any favorites as far as not just the writings, but are there any? Shall we, if we can put it in this context, do you have any favorite messengers of the message that they brought?
Oh, God, there's so many. In addition to the people I've already mentioned, you know, I've read so much over the course of my life, it's hard for me to choose which ones I favor. You know, I have 15 different translations of the Bhagavad Gita and commentaries, and I'm often asked which one I like best. And the truth is, I there is none that I like best. I find passages in one superior, and then passages in another, you know, better. One thing I will say is, in the early days of my path, I read people like Houston Smith, Alan Watts, Aldous Huxley, who were brilliant interpreters of the traditional teachings. Joseph Campbell as well.
Oh, yes.
And those I found tremendously important because they were gifted writers and thinkers serving as intermediaries between the original texts or the, you know, the classic works and the influential teachers and me. And I found that kind of commentaries and interpretations very worthwhile. Nowadays, there are, you know, tons of them, including me, for God's sake, you know, who are, you know, interpreting these things, putting them into modern vernacular, explaining things. I find the original sources like the Gita and the Upanishads indispensable, but the commentaries and explanations are, you know, also extremely valuable, but I don't want to play favorites.
Okay. No, I understand. I remember, too, going through and interviewing a gentleman, and we're going back to the 80s, and he was a fundamentalist Christian who, you know, who was really challenging Christendom because he felt that, you know, we've been lied to, and I've found out how to differentiate between the truths and the lies. And what he did was, And I thought, I did this myself because I'm one of those people who, it's great for me to say, well, you know, Philip Goldberg in his book, The Life of Yogananda, said, but if I can have access to the primary source information, then I can say I found that, and I can show you where you can find it. So I took one of my Bibles, and I took a concordance, and I laid them side by side, and this was per this gentleman's instruction. And I looked a particular passage up, and I looked up the specific words, and I came to the same conclusion that he did. Of course, you have to assume that both the book of the Bible that you're using and the Strong's Concordance that I was using, you have to take it with without an argument that, okay, these are valid sources, okay? These are valid sources of information, and so we have to start somewhere in our debate and our discussion. And so I find it fascinating that these other ancient wisdom teachings, these other writings that even you and I both mentioned over the program here, they weren't written in English, okay? And this is one of the paradoxes that I find fascinating. They weren't written in English. The Bible wasn't written in English. It's been translated time and time again. All of these have been into other languages in addition to English. And one of the interesting paradoxes is we have a document that supposedly we're supposed to run this country by. It's called the Constitution of the United States. And most specifically...
Well, at least that was written in English.
Well, maybe so. But this is to my point. The Second Amendment, for example, in reference to the right to bear arms, in particular, that is just and I did some research on that, and the debate over what that amendment means has been going on for nearly 200 years. In other words, it was written in English, and yet we're still debating over what the meaning is of that, and yet we've got people who are telling us that they have the English translation of the Bible or the Gita or the Quran or the Torah or the Tao and so on and so forth. And it wasn't written in our language. And every time you translate from the original language out of it into another, you lose so much context. And that's why I'm grateful, of course, that Paramahansa wrote his book, and you've written yours both in English. So at least there's a fair explanation. But one of my favorite aspects of autobiography, the words he used, words that you would not ordinarily hear in day-to-day conversation amongst ordinary citizens.
Mm-hmm.
I just love the plethora of and diversity of the vocabulary list that he used in describing certain things and accounts and so forth. What about your perspective on, let's say, the power thereof, the power of words, and your work, The Life of Paramahansa, of Yogananda, in terms of what you've put down into print that's now available for people to pick up at Amazon or any other book outlet and so forth, they can order it. What are you wanting to say through this particular work? What's your message to the reader?
I had several purposes. One, I hope people just enjoy a good read. It's a compelling, interesting story. How Mukunda Lal Ghosh was born in India in 1893 and became Paramahansa Yogananda, the world teacher who we're still talking about today and from whom people are still learning. It's a great story with a lot of drama and a lot of unexpected stuff. I will tell people listening, if you think you know everything there is to know about Yogananda, you're still in for a lot of surprises. If you read my book, that's just on the level of Phil, the writer and storyteller, hoping people have a rip-roaring good time reading the book. Phil, who values spiritual teachings and the immense importance of integrating the insights of the with our Western way of life, feels very strongly that if you read my biography of Yogananda carefully and pay attention, you will find teachings that will benefit your own personal development, your own spiritual path. They're just sort of sprinkled throughout, but primarily, I came to appreciate Yogananda as a for certain aspects of the spiritual path that we all have to deal with. He was different from 99% of us in that he was a renunciate. He was a Swami. He did not marry or have children or any of that kind of thing. But he was very much engaged in the world. He was not living in a cave. He was not living in an ashram in, you know, some small village in India. He had a big mission, and he was a public figure. He created, by necessity, even though he was reluctant, large organization that required buildings and properties that were mortgaged, that had bills to pay, that had people to manage. He had opponents. He had people trying to prevent him from succeeding in his work. He had people who turned on him and subjected him to humiliating lawsuits that were played out in public. He was treated badly by racists and religious bigots. So he had a life in the world with obstacles and challenges, as well as pleasures and delights, because he really enjoyed certain things about being in the world. And he had tension in that part of him often wanted to just go back to India and live a simple life. So in that, this highly evolved spiritual being whose main priority in life was to achieve union with the divine, but had worldly responsibilities, and did his best to fulfill both sides of that coin, he stands as a useful role model to the rest of us who are essentially trying to do the same thing. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And I am very I'm grateful for you giving us so much time here on the program to discuss this, and certainly we could go on. And you do speaking engagements all over the country, if not around the world as well. And you were actually in Santa Barbara to converse about this at Sacred Space with Jack and Rose Hirschhorn. And I'm fascinated by the fact that more and more people, and it's encouraging to me, it keeps me optimistic, who are continuing to ask these kinds of questions and be curious about the spiritual life, and it's a spiritual life, but it's also the internal life, as it were, because nothing happens on the external without it first happening on the inside. And so I'm just grateful for people such as yourself who are getting the word out through the print and other areas to you know, help people to understand. And that's really what we're in need of today, is that level of understanding.
Well, I thank you, and I appreciate those kind words very much.
First of all, I want to thank you again for joining us here on the program, and I also encourage you, if we get the opportunity the next time you're in Santa Barbara, we would love to have you in studio for a continuation of this conversation, not only about this work, but certainly works that you will have done since this particular program, but also talking more maybe about the American Veda and some of the other things that you've done, and just kind of see where the program goes.
Sure, I'm happy to be back anytime, Richard, in person or by Skype, whatever you choose. Thank you for the good questions. And maybe I'll see you when I'm there at Sacred Space on the 12th of August.
PhilipGoldberg.com. That's PhilipGoldberg.com. That's the website you can go to. We'll be linked to it as well at RichardDugan.com. So you'll be able to check that out as well as listen to the interview. And we encourage you to do that and pick up a copy of the book, The Life of Yogananda. Before we let you go, three final questions, if I may. And again, my thanks to you and also to you folks for listening to the program. It's always great to know that you're out there. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, hey, the email is TMYS for Tell Me Your Story, TMYS@RichardDugan.com. First of the three questions, Philip, is who is Philip Goldberg?
He's an author, teacher, and resident of Los Angeles on one level, and he is infinite spirit like the rest of us on another level.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Say again?
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I truly hope that I can be of service in helping people move along the spiritual path with more grace and ease and speed. That would be my hope, and my hope would be I can contribute in some way to making it a better world.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
Well, I think I just articulated it, but on a deeper level, my life's purpose is the same as Yogananda's and everybody else's, which is to realize the highest levels of my potential.
Philip Goldberg, again, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you, Richard. It's been fun.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.